Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Well, we're in for another weekend, which is great because we could use a couple of days off. We are at, what are we at now? 93 days, 92 days until the election. This was not, I would say, Donald Trump's best week. We're joined today by Amanda Carpenter, who is a CNN contributor, author, longtime political insider, and a political columnist for The Bulwark. Welcome back, Amanda.
Hey, Charlie, not Donald Trump's best week, but your best month ever when it comes to podcast downloads. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's, you know, there's just certain moments where you just tell the people are locked in and you hope it continues, but there's no guarantees on all of that. But hopefully you can get us over the top because I'm figuring this podcast will put us over. I think we'll break 17 million total downloads with this podcast.
All right, I'm your closer. Listeners, don't let me down. Send this one to your friends to pump our numbers up.
Okay.
There are end of the month before you get an email that's over the top Trump style.
Yeah, this is the end of the month. We have to sell these final cards. You know, do you get those emails from the Trump folks? The ones, why have you been ignoring us? Amanda, we've written you five times. We're going to have to cancel your special platinum status if you don't. Why are you abandoning your president? Are you getting those?
I opted into everything when I was writing pieces about their digital strategy, but luckily I filed my piece, I think the day the text message came from Don Jr. saying, should I tell my father you're not interested?
Oh, geez.
So that was really perfect timing for me.
Well, it's interesting because even people in the really the hardcore Trump world are getting a little bit creeped out by all of this. The psychology of the are these leftovers from the Death Star? This is the Death Star approach, which is we're going to beat the crap out of you, we're going to guilt you, we're going to shame you, and then you're going to send money because you really want that Trump T-shirt.
Yeah, that was definitely the Pascal approach, and now the Trump campaign is pausing all of their ads now that Bill Stepien has taken over, which is really interesting. A point you always make, there's only 100 days left on the clock. And now you're pausing your ads to figure out what your message is after you've spent $1 billion and there's 100 days to go. Good luck with that.
That's a pretty dramatic tell, isn't it?
Yeah. You think at this point they would have a clue. But this is what happens when you have a shakeup this late in the campaign. Taking the time to pause your ad buys, that means they're going to reevaluate all their data. They're going to reorganize their comps chart. They're going to do new focus groups. They're essentially starting over in August. And you know how this new tone stuff works out. You spend a lot of money. You spend a lot of time. You send people on a lot of fire drills. And Trump is just going to go straight back to the Twitter machine and tweet about suburban housewives and what they want. You know, do the real white knight strategy, like real white knighting suburban housewives.
You've gone right to the core of course, which is that they don't have a messaging problem. It's not the messaging, it's the candidate, and they can't do anything about the candidate. There is no new tone. So let's talk about the big distraction yesterday. In my newsletter, I actually posted the front pages of newspapers around the country. New York Daily News, three men and a baby. As past presidents honor Lewis, pouty Trump touts delaying election. It's got a big picture of Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. And then there's a pouty Donald Trump. And that's not the worst of the headlines. Washington Post, big banner headline, U.S. economy contracts at record rate. New York Times, all the way across the top. Virus wipes out 5 years of economic growth. So I suppose there's not a total mystery why the president would be tweeting out the suggestion, not serious suggestion, that he is going to delay the election. But again, this is part of the strategy. I mean, obviously, he knows he can't delay the election. But as you point out, he's gaslighting the nation because he's setting us up to delegitimize this election and to challenge the mail-in ballots and to argue that he didn't lose the election. It was stolen from him, right?
Yeah, it's far better to be the victim than the loser, right? And this
in
is
Trump
what,
world, yeah.
Yeah, this is what Trump does. He has gaslit his way to becoming president, and he never changes it. And, you know, this isn't just because he tells lies and he likes lying. people who are extreme manipulators, which Trump is, they do this to regain a sense of control. Things are out of control for Trump right now. 150,000 Americans have died. The only thing going on in Washington right now is how many more trillions we're going to need to keep the economy on life support. And he's losing to a guy that he thinks in his mind is like the guy in Weekend at Bernie's that AOC is going to dress up and stick on a debate stage. He can't believe he's losing to Joe Biden. And so now we got to mess with the election. He knew this was going to shake everything up. And while a lot of people are heartened by the fact like, oh, well, now this time some Republicans spoke out against Trump. Oh, well, congratulations. This is like answering the person question on person, woman, camera, TV. This is basic. Hey, can the president lose the election? No, that's a test where you get half the points for answering name right.
Slow clap. Good, good.
Yeah. McConnell couldn't even answer it right. When he was first asked on the Hill yesterday, you know, these Hill reporters stake everybody out, get 100 of them in line. McConnell couldn't even comment. That is really, 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 really pathetic.
Well,
and then he has to call his hometown reporter guy and clarify that, oh, yes, maybe this is set in stone. It is such a joke, Charlie.
Well, that's what John Cornyn said, right? I think it's a joke. I laughed. I thought, my gosh, this is going to consume a lot of people except real people. And it was clever. So that was the, hey, don't take it seriously. This was just to cause liberals' heads to explode.
So funny. We might have a tyrant dictator in charge.
Well, this is the thing about the funny, and people have gotten locked into all of this. I mean, people, we're in the midst of this public health emergency, an economic meltdown, and the defense of the president is that he's joking about subverting democracy because that's hilarious. It's hilarious. So I have to ask you about one of the strangest things that happened yesterday. Stephen Calabresi is one of the founders of the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society has been joined at the hip with the Trump administration. They're the pipeline for all of the federal judges. And they have been very, very, shall we say, Trump-friendly. Calabresi, in fact, is so Trump-friendly, he wrote a very controversial op-ed piece at one point saying that the entire Mueller investigation was unconstitutional. I mean, it was Trumpian with hair on it. And it was so controversial, even within the Federalist Society, they had to have a conference call to make it clear that he's not actually speaking for the Federalist Society, that they still have, you know, some intellectual independence. Well, yesterday, Calabresi writes an editorial, I mean, an op-ed piece in the New York Times, saying that not only was it reprehensible that Donald Trump had tweeted out about the possibility of delaying the election, that he thought the tweet itself was grounds for impeachment and removal from office. This from the co-founder of the Federalist Society, Amanda Carpenter. What do you make of that?
Hey, hey, welcome to the resistance. listen, on its face, I think it's absurd for this reason. He, as this huge constitutional respected lawyer, didn't think that leveraging official acts to solicit foreign interference in the form of a sham investigation against your political opponent was fine. That's what impeachment was about when it came to Ukraine. Nothing to say about that. Now, all of a sudden you come out of the woodwork and you're over the edge about kind of a random tweet Donald Trump posted about the election, and it's stuff he said before. And so that to me doesn't make sense at all. It's not logical. It's not consistent. Yeah, maybe you can say, well, these guys are just looking for a lifeboat at this time. Trump is the Titanic. They just want to get off the ship. I think there's more than that. This isn't an op-ed that, ooh, wow, look, FedSoc guy turns on Trump and he has a message for Republican senators, which is what the op-ed was about. His audience is Republican lawyers. He is head of the Federalist Society. These is nothing but legal geeks that want to get clerkships, appointments, and big campaign jobs being campaign finance lawyers. Like, these are DC Republican lawyers that are fodder for the machine. And what is Donald Trump doing? He's talking about lawsuits. There's been a spattering of news stories. I've covered this stuff for The Bulwark about how he thinks his only way to challenge this election in a legitimate way is through lawsuits. He is talking about Bush versus Gore style recounts in his press conference yesterday. His campaign mm-hmm. suing the state of Pennsylvania. To make that happen, you need really smart lawyers. And what Calabresi is saying, we're not on board with this. You want to mess with the election date? No, we're not doing this. Really? We think you should be impeached. And so I think that's a message to the Republican lawyer rank and file. Don't go there.
Huh. Well, that would be a major development. To your first point, though, I think it was a brilliant point that, you know, for Calabresi to have gone along with everything in the Trump administration, to have, you know, been able to swallow the Russian story, the Ukrainian story, all of this stuff, and then to wake up and go, okay, but this tweet, this is too much. This is the breaking point. It just seems like kind of a strange move. But, you know, if you're right about this, then yesterday was really a pivotal moment in the campaign, because the president is obviously all in questioning the legitimacy of the election, attacking the mail-in vote. And number one, Republicans clearly broke with him on that. There's no support in Congress for moving it. I mean, you know, with rare exceptions, everybody said, yeah, we're not doing that. If, in fact, the legal community is declaring some independence, that would be a big deal. But I also thought, and by the way, you feel free to push back on me, because I have this thing in my head going, don't ever say that anything's a turning point, because nothing's ever a turning point. And it's so easy to overstate the significance of something that we're going to forget about 4 years. I mean, 4 minutes from now. So I was thinking about, and I wrote this up for my newsletter today, about, you know, Trump going again all in on this campaign about the mail-in ballots and what a fraud it is. That yesterday we really saw what an epic mistake it was. I mean, not just because he was repudiated on the moving the election, but every poll that I've seen shows overwhelming support for mail-in balloting. Pew survey has it at 65%. Even Republicans are divided on the issue, not to mention the fact that if you really do succeed in stigmatizing mail-in ballots, you might succeed in suppressing your own vote. But the big takeaway from yesterday was watching that John Lewis funeral and the eulogy from President Obama. Now, bear with me here, because I have a feeling this is one of those things where I'll go, okay, nah, it didn't actually do that. But it did feel like a moment. It felt almost like Obama was springing this trap, that Donald Trump is all in on suppressing of the vote, questioning the vote, opposing efforts for voting rights. And then Barack Obama stands up and reminds people that voting rights is one of the most resonant, powerful, emotional issues in a modern American political history. You wanted a rallying cry for Democratic voters, not just African-American voters. You got it. So he's basically saying, look, Donald Trump is attacking your right to vote and drawing the line all the way back to Selma. This was a powerful moment. And here Republicans have got to be going, oh, man, we have created a wedge issue that we are guaranteed to lose, if you follow where I'm going here. So you had the feeling that the way the day played out was about a worst case scenario for Trump, because this is, look, there's a kind of a stark choice. You either want to have more people, you want to make it easier for people to vote and participate in democracy, or you want to make it harder for people to vote. And Republicans seem to have been, you know, right now, they are all in on, let's make it harder for people to vote. Amanda, this is just not a political winner this year.
It's not, but they're going to try to thread the needle. Even in the statements yesterday about Republicans, like I believe Liz Cheney and Ted Cruz talking about why Trump can't move the election, they all kind of couched it. But of course, we got to look at fraudulent ballots and protect against voter fraud, right? So they're kind of protecting this lane where I sincerely believe they're going to challenge mail-in ballots because they already are in Pennsylvania. And so when this happens on election day or week or month, it's going to happen very fast. There's going to be some random report of something happening. Lawyers are going to swarm down there and try to throw the entire election based on some small findings of something somewhere. I mean, you have to expect that, because this election is going to look different because of the mail-in voting.
But no, what I don't understand is
where Trump is getting hung up on absentee versus mail-in voting, and voters don't see a distinction. I mean, all we're really talking about here is whether you apply, you proactively ask for an application to vote absentee, or they mail you the application to vote by mail. I mean, that's all it is. But they're trying to conflate that, because they got caught early with all of their staffers voting by mail. I mean, do you think Donald Trump has ever voted in person in his entire life?
Oh, no.
I
mean,
I don't think so.
Not at all. No.
And so they got caught on that early. And that's very good. But there's still a lot of battles going on. And even the case in Pennsylvania where his lawyers are contesting the mail-in system, they're not even really arguing about the fact that applications were mailed out. They are arguing about the drop-off boxes that were set up to deliver them to local election boards, which a lot of states are doing, a lot of people like. But Charlie, there are some issues there. I mean, what if you have a drop box that isn't monitored all the time? I think that is somewhat of a legitimate complaint. There's sure. places, I mean, should you be able to set up a voter drop box in a McDonald's parking lot? Probably not. But can you keep it in a government building? Yeah, I think that's legit. So those are issues that need to be sorted out by states. And I think those are legitimate discussions to have, but just tar and feathering the whole system is certainly not the way to go. No,
you're right. And I think it's a very dangerous time. I think people who are thinking, well, there's only 93 days until the election. It's 93 plus whatever the number of days is from the election to the inauguration, because whatever level of chaos you might fear, you're going to get. And of course, there's the long-term damage of delegitimizing democracy, making Americans think that the election can't be trusted. So all of those things, I think, are real dangers. I guess I was trying to just step back and think about the culture war issue. And, you know, Donald Trump right now is flailing. He feels he's losing and he's flailing. And so he thinks that I'm going to fire up one culture war after another. This is the wrong culture war for him. He's picked the wrong fight at the wrong time, because if you want to motivate voters on the left to come out, this is one of the issues. This is going to fire them up. I know that a lot of conservatives care about voter fraud and stuff, but this is not their hot button issue. It's a hot button issue on the left. So I think that he's now found himself with a culture war that probably. Well, I understand that in his mind, this is all he's got, right? I mean, real at this point, when you're losing the election, the chaos, the disruption, the doubt, and all of the suspicion, that's the only card he's got to play. But it is a very, very risky card.
Well, I think before the pandemic, there was a larger sort of quiet discussion among Republicans about whether it should be hard or easy to vote. I mean, we know where the Democrats are. They think voting should be super simple. You should be able to do it at a gas station, no questions asked, whatever. They're like, make it easy, mail it out. Who cares? We'll just count it later. but I know many Republicans who view it as this duty that, no, you should stand in line. If you are a serious voter, then you would certainly take the time out to go stand in line on election day and present a photo ID, which, I like the photo ID thing. But they viewed that as a civic duty. And if you weren't willing to do that, well, then maybe you weren't a good voter. I mean, I've heard that kind of stuff.
Oh, no, I understand that. Yeah.
And the pandemic has certainly, I wasn't in that camp, but has made me think much more seriously about why do we impose those obstacles? And I started thinking about that watching the Iowa caucus and the Democrats. Mm-hmm. Like, Why do they make people stand there for 4 hours to participate? I mean, who really has the time? And so that's the first time I really started thinking seriously about why do we make this so hard? And what's funny is that Benjamin Wittes wrote an article for The Atlantic, was it yesterday, about Never Trump Republicans? Mm-hmm. And he noted that, yeah, the Never Trump Republicans have somehow gotten more sensitive about voter access issues. And that certainly applies to me. And I wonder how many other Republicans that applies to, and whether it's because of coronavirus or because it's Trump or exactly why, because I can't distinctly pinpoint when I started turning that over in my mind.
No, I agree with you completely on that. And I'm certainly one of them as well. And, I've been thinking about this. I mean, I do understand. I wish people would be willing to concede some good faith among people who were concerned about voter integrity, who were concerned about voter fraud. And because I think there was a fair-minded concern about that. But having said that, if you put in balance the what the evidence suggests about how rare voter fraud is, and then you look at the systemic scope of the voter suppression efforts that have been put in place afterwards. I mean, you know, in response, there is a fundamental issue here about whether or not we really do believe in democracy, whether or not you actually want a lot of people to vote and participate in the system. And I think that Republicans became very, very comfortable with the idea that we wanted the turnout to be as low as possible, that we don't want that if the wrong kind of people voted, if we made it too easy for them to vote, that we would lose elections and therefore we can't do that. Well, wait, whoa, you know, that is fundamentally anti-democratic. It is by definition anti-democratic. And so I do think that there's been an evolution on this issue. And this is a fundamental issue. I went back recently and I watched the movie Selma before, you know, John Lewis passed away, and really was struck. I was reminded that that whole march was about voting rights and the centrality of voting rights and social justice and civil rights. We, I think, on the right had forgotten that and have forgotten the emotional power of it. And I think we were reminded of that yesterday. Okay, one last thing on this, moving the election. Did you hear Mike Pompeo yesterday, Amanda?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay, let's play this. Now, in fairness to Mike Pompeo, he's the Secretary of State, and he clearly doesn't want to answer this. But this is a remarkable exchange. He's talking with Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. Let's play this.
Can a president delay the November presidential election, Mr. Secretary?
Senator, I'm not going to enter a legal judgment on that on the fly this morning.
Mr. Secretary, you are an honors graduate of West Point. You are a graduate of the Harvard Law School. You were on the Harvard Law Review. I was at Harvard Law School, and I went to a lot of Red Sox games. I went on the Harvard Law Review. You are
very kind of you. Thank you.
You are one of the most highly trained and accomplished lawyers who are part of this administration. Can a president delay a presidential election?
Senator, the Department of Justice, others will make that legal determination. We all should want, I know you do too, Senator Kaine, want to make sure we have an election that everyone is confident in. That's not only for
you. Are you indifferent to the date of the election?
It should happen lawfully.
Right.
Yeah.
Amanda Carpenter.
This is why you got to burn it down.
Why?
Mike Pompeo, if Trumpism survives in any form, it most certainly will be in the vehicle of Mike Pompeo. If there's anybody in the Trump universe that I think is best positioned to parlay a 2024 presidential run in a way that echoes something of the Trump era, it's Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, because guess what? He is a smart guy. He does know better. And yet, when he is asked the most basic constitutional election question while testifying before Congress, he can't tell the truth. Burn it down.
What did you make of Tucker Carlson lashing out at Obama last night as well, referring him to as one of the most sleazy, corrupt politicians? It was interesting to me that Carlson felt the need to go that hard against Barack Obama.
Because Barack Obama still has a lot of power, and Tucker has to say something to take it down, because he still is messaging, I think, on behalf of the Trump administration. You know what's really funny? Everybody went through Tucker's suspension. Was it last month, this month, over the racist writer that he was employing, yeah, got caught employing, and then blamed on the CNN reporters that wrote about it. That was the second time Tucker has been suspended from, or wait, excuse me, took a
vacation,
impromptu fishing trip to Maine on a day's notice. The second time in the last year. He did the same thing last August. I don't know if you remember, you know, the El Paso shooting where that white supremacist rolled up people. And then in the aftermath of that, he said white supremacy is a hoax. And that was after Charlottesville and after South Carolina church shooting and everything else. And so he's Fox's top anchor right now. He's getting more ratings than Kennedy. He's been suspended twice. And when the first black president gets up at John Lewis's funeral, he calls him a greasy politician. I mean, Tucker Carlson has not learned his lesson. He never will. And he keeps getting these profiles written, what happened to Tucker Carlson. And I know you've had Eliana Plott on. She wrote one of them, mm-hmm. and it was probably one of the best ones. And she had the insight included in that piece about how Tucker has failed in the past, and now he's found success. And so how has he found success? He started on CNN, went to MSNBC, to Dancing with the Stars, and then became this raging Trump racist populist on Fox News, who essentially just translates the froth of the alt-right into something somewhat more palatable for a 65-plus audience on Fox at night. That's how he found success. That's what he does now. And so I guess example number two of this conversation, burn it down.
Well, I also think that it was a recognition of maybe Tucker saw the same thing that I saw. I don't disagree with anything you said, by the way, but how powerful the Obama card is in this election. That this is really something that Republicans are going to have to deal with the contrast between Obama and Trump. I think is going to be something that we're going to have through November. Okay, so you know, I have really avoided commenting.
I know what you're going to say.
I know. Commenting on the death of Herman Cain. And I think that there has been some tasteless commentary about all of it. And you want to be sensitive about, you know, the fact that he did pass away. So I guess the question is, though, will the fact that Herman Cain, who was very outspokenly opposed to masks, very outspokenly against many of the efforts to mitigate the coronavirus, does his death under these circumstances, will it change any minds? Will anyone in Trump world, any of the Republicans go, wow, this happened to Herman Cain. Maybe we ought to rethink our position.
I think it has to. They'll never admit it.
You think it will?
Very, very quietly. I mean, circumstances have changed dramatically since Donald Trump held that rally in Tulsa on June 20th, where Herman Cain was there unmasked, taking photos. And a month later, he's dead. I mean, that rally was on June 20th. Herman Cain is dead, announced yesterday.
Yeah.
Another guy, Bill Montgomery, who created Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk was on his podcast the other day talking about, it's my body, my choice. I don't want to wear a mask. The guy who created him is dead. That has to have an effect. And I do not expect any of these people to come out and say, oh, I was wrong. But they've gotten a little bit more quiet. There's no Republican convention now, right? What's Trump going to do? Some kind of Zoom call from North Carolina? So I would never expect them to admit it. But I have got to think this has a profound effect on people who thought this was a hoax. It wouldn't happen to them when it is striking down their mentors. I mean, if that is not a cause for deep reflection, absolutely nothing, nothing will be.
I wish I agreed with you on all of this, but I'm looking at Jeremy Peters from the New York Times, his tweet on, he did a story, Will Herman Cain's Death Change Republican Views? You know, noting that Cain's publicly dismissive attitude about the pandemic reflected the hands-off inconsistency of many party leaders. But he tweeted out last night, he said, one reason why it probably won't make any difference is that conservatives aren't likely, at least the grassroots folks, aren't likely to read or hear in their media that Cain, number one, refused to wear a mask, number two, went to the Trump rally, and number three, boasted about it on social media. I think that's true, but I also just think the almost infinite capacity we've seen for rationalization or just simply moving on to something else, you know, the strategic silence that we often see. You know, there's some people in Trump world or the anti-Trumpers who are interesting tells, and what they will do is you can almost sort of tell there's like, this is bad, and take a breath, let's not say anything for a while, and then we'll just move on to something else, as opposed to, wow, you know what, I'm going to rethink this. We were wrong. Because, you know, admitting you were wrong is one of the hardest things in the world. Admitting you're wrong 90 days out from a presidential election is asking a lot for people who've shown an almost rather extraordinary capacity to rationalize.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I will note, it's the strategic silence and then pivoting is what happens. That's what Fox News did, correct? I mean, everybody talked about how the masks were bad. We're not going to do this. And then, oh, look at that. Sean Hannity is putting on a mask in prime time. And so I would expect more of that because it's the only thing you can do. But in the interim, I agree with you. I've seen a lot of it. Well, don't politicize this. You can't blame Trump on this. Well, no one is blaming Trump on Herman Cain's death. But you have to look at the circumstances. This guy who a lot of people revered, loved, respected, was walking around laughing with his friends last month. And he's gone. And on the Twitter feed, his supporters are saying, oh, he's going to be all right. He's just having some oxygen therapy. No, that's not true. He was taken because of this deadly, deadly virus.
And I think, you know, the part of it is, I understand the pushback, like, don't politicize this, don't say anything about this. But you also have to acknowledge that these folks are influencers and that there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people who are taking their cues from people like Herman Cain, Donald Trump, Don Jr., Louis Gohmert, and are endangering themselves and others. And so don't say anything about the Herman Cain or Louis Gohmert line is like, well, wait, if in fact there are people who are out in the world who are endangering their lives. Look, I mean, there's a point at which we need to keep reminding ourselves we're talking about 150,000 human lives, and the number of lives that have been affected, the number of families that have been ripped apart, the number of people who have not necessarily died, but whose health will be impaired for the rest of their lives. This human cost is breathtaking, and it is tempting to become numbed by it or to normalize it. In fact, I think that's what the Trump White House was hoping, that at a certain point, you know, the numbers were just numbers, you know, that, okay, 150,000, is that any, you know, more politically salient than 120,000? Okay, 200,000. Is that really a big deal? So when you have somebody you know and you can put a face to it and there are real consequences, you mock this, you refuse to wear the mask, you minimize it, you go to the rally, and then you die. I don't see how we don't at least put the focus on that for a while.
Yeah, I think you have to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's political because, yeah, this handling of the virus has become intensely politicized by the president. And if we're not going to talk about this, what will we talk about? I mean, honestly, this is what the most important thing we're facing. And you have a former presidential candidate on a first name basis with a lot of Republican households who's gone. And you have members of the Trump campaign, Kimberly Guilfoyle, Donald Trump's girlfriend, contracted it and, you know, had to get a private plane back, which they lied about and said they were going to drive back. I mean, the games that they are playing are with people's lives. And so, yes, we should talk about it, but maintain his memory and do it in a respectful way. But Herman Cain was an extremely smart man, and I can't imagine that he would want his memory just to be dusted under and for us not to say something about these circumstances, because I really do believe if he had known what was going to happen, he would have changed course.
Oh, sure. Yes, absolutely. And certainly the people who loved him and around him would have done it as well. So what should we talk about as well? We need to talk about Jared Kushner, don't we? This story, there's a story in Vanity Fair that I got to tell people. It is a jaw-dropping story. It's about Jared Kushner and the whatever happened to the national testing policy. You've seen this, right, Amanda?
I have.
Let me read you three paragraphs. Just three paragraphs. I would recommend the whole thing, but three paragraphs. Against that background, the prospect of launching a large-scale national plan for testing was losing favor, said one public health expert in frequent contact with the White House's official task force. Here's the key paragraph. Most troubling of all, perhaps, was the sentiment the expert said a member of Kushner's team expressed. that because the virus had hit the blue states hardest, a national plan was unnecessary and would not make sense politically. Quote, the political folks believed that because it was going to be relegated to Democratic states, that they could blame those governors, and that would be an effective political strategy, said the expert. That logic may have swayed Kushner. Quote, it was very clear that Jared was ultimately the decision maker as to what plan was going to come out, the expert said. Wow. Wow. Is this one of those shocking but not surprising stories, though?
It reinforces what John Bolton has been saying, in that the Trump administration views everything through the lens of politics, because what they're talking about here is essentially political triage in the worst, most deadly sense of the word. Sacrifice, you know, make New York a sacrifice zone. Who cares if New Yorkers die because they're not our voters? And you saw that in the initial response.
Our
right?
voters and not our voters. Red states versus blue states. My America versus that other America. That's scary. Absolutely. This is chilly. This is scary shit. That the president of the United States doesn't think of us as Americans or as human beings, but simply as red or blue little pegs.
Yeah, and we saw that in the Trump response, beating up on Cuomo, talking about testing facility. I mean, Larry Hogan, didn't he procure his tests from South Korea and put them in the National Armory to protect them from being seized by the federal government?
Yeah.
Right. So even if you're a Republican in a sort of blue state, you're still taking actions like that because this is what was happening behind the scenes. And it absolutely is chilling. And, you know, you want to talk about nepotism. There's a nepotism angle, but this is the problem I think Trump has across the board in his administration, is he keeps putting in people with no governing experience who don't know how to make the ships run on time. So the only way they can make decisions is through politics and how it will benefit Trump in one way or another. I mean, you got Chad Wolf. I mean, just very young people who don't have the practical experience of shipping out supplies, finding out what people need, understanding the metrics. And the only thing they have to fall back on is the politics and whether this is a good message.
You know, and I keep falling back on this word as well. It's the lack of human empathy that keeps striking me. The lack of normal human sentiment that I'm not saying that everybody in politics has it, but you would hope that there would be people who, because of their contact with other people, they're in their own lives, their fundamental humanity, which hasn't been blotted out by electoral politics, who would not think in this particular way. But, you know, we're at the beginning of August. By the time a lot of people listen to this, we will be in August. We're 90 days from a presidential election. And we are seeing not just the failure of competence, but what it says about the fundamental values of the folks who are running the country right now. And I want Democrats to stay nervous about it. I want everybody to stay nervous and concerned about it. But, you know, how do American voters look at this and not grasp just the fundamental failure and appalling outrage of all of this?
Well, a lot of voters wait until September and October to start thinking seriously.
Do they still do that?
Yeah, I think that's by and large for most people, but most people's lives have been dramatically affected by coronavirus. And so maybe they are thinking about it earlier, but the turn is coming. I just speaking as a parent with young kids about what's happening this fall. I've said it before. We've been home since March. We've gone through summer, not going anywhere. And school plans are going to be announced about in the next week or two about whether schools are going to open or stay shut. And so going into another round of 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, probably through Christmas, if we're being really realistic here, of doing at-home learning, trying to keep the job going and not going anywhere, not seeing family, I've got to believe the fury is going to be out of control. But on the other side of that, because everyone is at home and wondering who to blame for this giant mess, there will be an increased focus on things like debates this time around. Mm-hmm. And we don't have two good, great debate performers coming up to speak. And Biden has been relatively quiet. That served him well. I think that's the right call by their campaign. But there is going to be a time for contrast. Expect the race to tighten a bit at some point in time. And Biden is going to have to come out and handle this. His vice president, who will be announced, next week, is going to have to handle this. And that's going to be something new that Republicans are going to want to kick the tires on and shake up and try to embarrass, exploit in opposition research. So all that is coming ahead. And that's when people will really start to make their decision.
So who do you think Biden's going to pick?
You know what? I have thought Kamala Harris was the best pick because, in my view, you need someone who has competed on the national presidential stage. You can't substitute for that.
Right.
But perhaps that has changed because no one is campaigning in the traditional sense anymore. That said, they need to have excellent communication skills and they do need to be ready on day one because of Joe Biden's age and I think overall condition, and people realize that you may need a vice president to take the reins in the next 8 years at some point in time. And so it is a higher test. And I've got to tell you, the other women who I've seen on TV aren't handling basic questions all that well. I'm thinking of, Stacey Abrams, Karen Bass. I think they're a little shaky. They don't have that game speed of running for a presidential election. And I am really worried about people talking about Susan Rice. I mean, do we really want to go through and litigate Benghazi again? That's really what Republicans know her for. She's never won an election. I don't think she's ever ran for an election. And her signature issue is lying to the American people about Benghazi. I don't think that is going to work, especially when Joe Biden considers himself this great foreign policy mind.
Yeah.
And so that's my knock on that. And it's coming if he picks her.
I just think what he needs to avoid is something that changes the narrative in a dramatic way, number one, or somebody who is not sufficiently vetted, who then provides some kind of a surprise, which is why I always keep coming back to somebody like a Kamala Harris. I share your concerns about Susan Rice, but the people who are, so I bounced that off somebody and they said, yeah, but the people who are most concerned about it are people who are, you know, Republicans were not going to vote for Joe Biden anyway. That's only that's something that's huge within the Republican conservative bubble, but it's not going to play outside that. I'm not sure that's true.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you, as a never Trump Republican, I have a big problem with the fact that she went on national television and lied about the death of American people on a YouTube video. I have a problem with that. I think that is bad. And I do think that Chris Dodd, in a very backwards way, gave Kamala Harris a leg up in the horse race because he essentially, or someone leaked, was it a Politico story? Somebody leaked that Chris Dodd said she was too ambitious, and wasn't sufficiently contrite for her attack on Joe Biden because she said, you know, she laughed, and she does laugh too much, that's just politics. Well, yeah, it was politics. She was trying to win. And listen, if Joe Biden picks her, they're going to have the great healing story of the two coming together. And Joe's going to say, you know, I have a lot to learn and Kamala's going to keep me in check and she's going to pat him on the back. And they're going to have that moment. And I just think that's what's obviously going to happen. But we'll see. We'll see.
Okay. The other extraordinary story that's playing out now has been the Republican inability to come up with a deal on the coronavirus relief package. This has been hanging fire. Today, we're taping this on Friday, marks the end of the $600 extra payment for the unemployment insurance. So that is going to lapse. I think there would have been an assumption that no one was going to allow that to happen. So maybe they'll put some, you know, short-term extension on. But you had a piece earlier this week in The Bulwark that was fantastic, just pointing out the extraordinary tone deafness of some of the Republicans in Washington, D.C., who thought that it would be a great idea to extend the to expand the deductibility of lunches and dinners, right? I mean, the three martini lunch, let's have it go from 50% deductible to a 100% deductible. You did not think that was a great idea.
No, I was baffled. This was a proposal, of course, supported by the Trump administration, by South Carolina Republican Tim Scott, who said the best way to help hospitality and restaurant workers would be to up the business meal deduction from 50% to 100%. In other words, you have a client dinner, you can write it off completely. My jaw seriously dropped. The only thing as stupid as that I've heard in the context of coronavirus bills was that a proposal by Martha McSally to have a tourism stimulus payment so people could go travel around the United States in the middle of a pandemic. And so this is like the lighter version of that, because who is traveling right now? Who's hosting business meals? I mean, who? Everybody's staying at home and putting on a mask, and you want to up the business meal deduction to 100%. Last time I checked, the cashier working at Food Lion isn't writing off her business meals. Although maybe she should be able to write off the dollar menu when she drives through there before she wears a mask for 12 hours so people can have groceries. I mean, it is just so insane.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was kind of laying in bed. I was like, well, what's the headline? And then it just popped in my head. Let them expense cake.
Well, your laid off couple trying to feed your kids is not going to be keeping all of their McDonald's receipts in order to get a tax write off later. I mean, this is one of those. I think you had a great line in there. This would be out of touch if there was any sort of remote way in which it was close to being in touch or whatever. But I was surprised it was Tim Scott who said it, but. The disconnect between the people, the policymakers, and what's happening out here in the real world, I thought was really on display there. Speaking of the disconnect, are you old enough to remember when the Senate actually operated as a legislative body? I bring this up because we're going through this major piece of legislation and nobody's even pretending that we're going to have a debate, that we're going to have hearings on it, that there's going to be a committee markup on it and all of this. It's all going to be decided in closed doors by a handful of individuals at the very last minute. And that's become the norm for years and years and years. And then we will spend time afterwards finding out what was in it, what were all the unintended consequences, which lobbyist got which pork, which senator was able to do something. And there's not even a pretense that we have an open and transparent legislative process.
No, the PPP program, I still can't believe it. To me, that was on the level of the bailouts and everything else. The fact that so much money got shoveled out the door and they didn't even want to tell us who got it. We had to fight to disclose the names of the companies that got millions and millions of dollars. That is just so beyond the pale to me. Like, what are we doing here? And then we want to fight over $600 that go to people that are unemployed. That just disconnect blows my mind. But what's interesting about this round of funding is the fact that Senate Republicans are kind of being cut out.
Yes.
Right? Steve Mnuchin knows, hey, he wants to spend a lot of money, right? He doesn't care. He just wants to get money out the door. Two companies, he doesn't want to, you know, extend those generous $600 a month unemployment benefits. But he wants to keep shoveling, you know, former hedge fund guy, billionaire in his own right. He wants to get money out to the companies. And he's going to the Democrats because he knows House Democrats will just shovel that money right out the door with them. The only opposition he has, it was maybe three or four Republicans in the Senate who might say, oh, can we please find out where that money is going again? And they're being cut out. And it is, they've gone home. Senate Republicans have gone home. There's a big debate
it's
over,
amazing.
Oh, should we be testing them? They're traveling all over the country. Mm-hmm. My question is, why in the hell are they traveling? They should be staying in Washington, working every minute to make sure the money is going out in a targeted way and people can finally get testing so we can open up schools in a safe way. But yet they're going home again.
They no longer act like they are a governing majority. You know, I mean, keep in mind that you have, you know, the presidency and the Senate, and yet you can tell they've already seemed to have morphed into a post-election mode where they're going back to some of the old habits that they have. And And, you know, it's always been a question about whether Republicans, who are very, very good in opposition, could actually put together a coherent governing philosophy and majority. And it barely seems like they're trying at the moment.
No, there was, I think NBC and the Washington Post reported about the Senate Republican lunch last week where Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz were fighting about getting money out the door, essentially. And Hawley was essentially saying, listen, we just got to spend it so we can, you know, try to stay in power.
Right.
And Cruz stood up and said, you know, what the hell are we doing here? And that's kind of the state of the Republican Party right now when it comes to governing. You have a wing of Trump Republicans who say, just do whatever you can to stay in power. Hang on. Who cares about the money? Maybe we'll count it later. And then other people saying, what the hell are we doing? And trying to back channel to the White House and play up to their insecurities as a way to figure it out. There's another story. I don't know if you've been following the Senate race in Kansas.
Oh, very much so. Yes.
Which is, again, further dividing the Republican Party. McConnell people are saying if they nominate Kris Kobach, they're sure to lose that that race and maybe probably even lose the Senate. You've got people like Jim DeMint and Ted Cruz saying, oh, we got to back Kris Kobach. It's just this never ending circle, right? And with Trump in charge, there's never a good decider. And so we're just locked in this doom loop. That's the new word these days, right?
Well, there's so many ways, there's so many applications for it. There's so many doom loops going on right now. It's like, how do you get out of the doom loop? No, that Kansas race is fascinating. I thought it was a particularly interesting tell that you have a Democratic group that's running ads that are subliminally designed to, you know, help Kris Kobach win the Republican nomination because they think he's so vulnerable. And not without reason, because, of course, you know, he managed to lose the governor's race in Kansas in 2018. And to say that a Republican losing a race in Kansas, you really have to be out there. And Kris Kobach is out there. And, you know, they tried to talk Mike Pompeo into running for that Senate seat for the longest time. And I think that there is that fear that if Kris Kobach is the nominee, that you have one more seat that is about to go. I mean, you know, your worst case scenario for the Republicans is not just you get blown out of the presidency, but that you get blown out of Senate seats that were on no one's radar screen 5 minutes ago. And this would be a perfect example, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And just to bring perhaps our discussion full circle is that after Kris Kobach lost that gubernatorial seat, Trump appointed him as head of a voter commission to find voter fraud, right? He was going to investigate all that voter fraud that had costed Trump the popular vote. And guess what? Kris didn't find anything. They had to disband it. And now Trump is back in the doom loop of 2020 saying, there's voter fraud. We've got to find this. And so maybe Kris can lose in another election and go be his election lawyer in one of these states. Maybe that's how this story ends.
Amanda Carpenter. At least, see, now this is why we need the weekend. So Amanda Carpenter, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. We appreciate it very much.
Thanks.
And thank you all for listening to this weekend's edition of the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.